Good day. Welcome to another episode of the Audible Local Ledger Reads to the Blind podcast. You can get more information at audiblelocalledger.org. Stay tuned for today's reading. Hi, my name's Eric, and I'll be reading you selections from the e-edition of today's Cape Cod Times. Today's date is Wednesday, May 31st of 2023. We'll start with the weather, as we always do, across the Cape and Islands today. The sun rose at 5:10 a.m. It will set at 8:08 p.m. We'll have 14 hours and 58 minutes of daylight on this beautiful day today. Sunny, with a high of 67 expected. Tonight, clear in the overnight, a low of 55. On Thursday, tomorrow, sun and clouds all through the day, high of 74. Low of 59. On Friday, high of 75, low of 58. Two gorgeous days ahead. And then on Saturday, we have it turning a little cloudy and chillier. Showers will be around. It'll be breezy with a high of 59, low of 50. Sunday looks to be partly sunny, breezy, and cool. No rain expected, but it will be partly cloudy in the morning. High of 59, low of 50. So it'll chill down over the weekend, but the next couple of days look to be beautiful. Now, heading to the front of the paper, where the news and lottery results are kept, and we read the lottery results because, well, someone asked for them. If there's something you would like read to the blind or those who are print disabled, you can email us at info@audiblelocalledger.org or call us at 508-539-2030, and we'll consider reading it. And if you miss any of the information that we share in our readings, you can always go to audiblelocalledger.org. And in the upper right corner is the Archived Readings tab. If you click on that, you'll find a week's worth of our newspaper readings, as well as a wide variety of periodicals and literature for your listening enjoyment, and our shopping guides up there for savings. All of that's free for the blind and the print disabled at the audiblelocalledger.org website. In the upper right corner, the Archived Readings tab. For the latest results of the lottery, we go to the masslottery.com website because the Cape Cod Times e-edition goes to press too early to give you the latest results. So, for the numbers game of Tuesday, May 30th, in the midday drawing, the numbers were 4, 2, 6, 2. Again, the midday drawing of the numbers game, 4, 2, 6, 2. The evening drawing, last night's numbers game results, 4, 0, 8, 9. 4, 0, 8, 9. The numbers game for Tuesday, May 30th, evening drawing results. Mass cash for Tuesday, May 30th, 3, 8, 15, 23, and 29. For Mega Millions last night, 13, 16, 40, 64, and 68, with 21, the bonus number. And rounding out our lottery results, Lucky for Life for Tuesday, May 30th of 2023, 25, 28, 35, 43, and 46, with 2, the bonus number. Good luck to all who play. Remember us if you win. From the cover of today's Cape Cod Times, the headline reads, Barnstable hopes to offer green burials soon, by Susan Vaughn, as a special to the Cape Cod Times. In Kitiwit, Mosswood Cemetery off Putnam Avenue has a new burial area that looks completely different than the rest of the 24 acres. There's a feel of a natural meadow, shaped in a semicircle, with a wooded backdrop. The uncut grass, the new native plantings of sumac and pussy willows, the start of the woodchip road around the site, the natural stone grave site markers, and plans for more pollinating plants to attract bees are there for a reason. The town is preparing for green burials at the cemetery, the first in all 14 of the town-managed cemeteries in Barnstable. We're just waiting for the regulations to be approved, cemetery foreman Michael Engelson said during a recent tour. Barnstable's proposing to join a growing environmentally friendly trend on Cape Cod, in the state and the nation, by providing an option of green burials. Detailed regulations have been written, a hearing has been held, and the public has until June 9th to email written comments on the proposals to Assistant Town Manager Andy Clyburn at Andy, A-N-D-Y, dot Clyburn, C-L-Y-B-U-R-N, at town.barnstable.ma.us. Once the public comment time is over, Clyburn said the new regulations can go into effect in a few weeks. There's a lot of interest in the new offering, if approved, and some of the 70 single, oversized 5-foot by 10-foot plots are already reserved, Engelson said. Larger plots allow the required extra space between graves. The green plots are only singles, he said. The graves also may be mounded, he said. The town council's already approved the money for a special wooden cart that's being constructed in Maine. A casket would be moved from the hearse on the main road and brought into the burial site on a quote-unquote funeral wagon, as specified in the regulations, Engelson said. So what's a green burial? Green burials forego the tradition of embalming a body with formaldehyde and placing it in a concrete vault as a way of caring for the dead with minimal environmental impact. The rules may vary, but most require a body be buried in a biodegradable shroud and natural wood or other biodegradable casket. Such natural burial procedures were used in the country before the Civil War and have always been used for Jewish and Muslim burials. The cemetery fees are in line with its standard fees, Cemetery Supervisor Joseph Marshall said at a May 10th hearing, and Barnstable's proposal conforms to Green Burial Council standards. There are currently over 400 known green burial cemeteries nationwide, which includes cemeteries that aren't Green Council certified, according to New Hampshire Funeral Resources and Education. So where can you have a green burial on Cape Cod? Of several Cape Cod towns that were contacted, Brewster, Provincetown, and Wellfleet have green burial sites in town cemeteries. Wellfleet was the most recent town to adopt green burial regulations last August for the Pleasant Hill Cemetery, Nancy Vale, chairman of the Wellfleet Cemetery Commission, said. A Zoom hearing in February of 2021, where the town invited other Cape Town representatives, helped the commission make its decision, as well as a lot of interest from residents, Vale said. Bourne, Harwich, and Sandwich officials reported they do not have green burials. Some Cape towns have only private cemeteries and no town cemetery commissions. What kind of casket is used in a green burial? To meet Green Council standards, the body must be in a ridged casket made of wood or wicker and free of toxic materials and held together with wooden dowels and non-toxic glues. Caskets of wicker, bamboo, or other natural materials must be free of toxic paints and varnishes. Barnstable's proposed regulations require the deceased be transported by a licensed funeral director, and proper transportation papers must accompany the deceased. Cemetery staff will assist with the scheduling and the burial process. Chris Luciano, president of the Doan, Beal and Ames Funeral Services on Cape Cod, said he was aware of the Barnstable proposal, and his funeral homes have assisted with green burials in Brewster and Wellfleet. They also can provide the simple containers. We will be ready and prepared for whatever people want, Luciano said. What other rules must a green burial follow? The new regulations came about as a result of inquiries and interest from the public, Barnstable Public Works Director Daniel Santos said at the May 10th hearing. Barnstable Precinct 1 Town Councilor Gordon Starr was the only person representing the public at the hearing. A constituent had ordered a wooden casket with metal hinges, and Starr asked if an exception could be made for that. Marshall said that no metal objects are allowed in green burials. Other regulations specify the placing of only live flowers and smaller gravestones that are flush to the ground. Are green burials safe for drinking water? The town regulations also require adequate separation of the green burial sites from private wells and from groundwater, as well as separation from areas of steep sloping ground in order to reduce the possibility of breakout. The state DEP has guidelines for green burials to protect private wells in groundwater. Bacteria, viruses, and other microorganisms potential to reach groundwater are one of the biggest public health concerns for green burials, according to the state. Our next headline, Offshore Wind Tower is Delivered, by Catherine Gallerani of the Standard Times. The UHL Felicity heavy load carrier will become a familiar sight in New Bedford as it makes repeated trips from Portugal to deliver parts of Vineyard Wind's offshore wind turbines to the New Bedford Marine Commerce Terminal. Sections of the towers for the first turbine that will be assembled and then installed this summer arrived in New Bedford on Wednesday night. The turbine blades will start arriving in mid-June. Mayor John Mitchell said it takes persistence and teamwork to get to this point with the arrival of the first components for Vineyard Wind, and New Bedford's prepared to compete so that in the years ahead, people can look back and say they made it happen and we're all better off for it. In that way, it's a great example of how one American city can move forward and thrive in the long run, he said. The work's not done. This is one project, and of course, there's a whole lot being set up in the harbor, a whole lot of investment happening in New Bedford. But I'll say it today, and again and again and again, New Bedford is prepared to compete. Vineyard Wind CEO Klaus Moeller said it's exciting times for the project and the city, with GE's technology about to turn northeastern wind into green, safe American energy, producing power to 400,000 homes starting this summer and for the next 30 years. When installed, the turbines will be as tall as three Statues of Liberty. He said it's special to be able to mark this milestone as he looks forward to a busy summer in New Bedford. These monsters are a very clear symbol that we are keeping our promises, he said. We are delivering offshore wind. We are delivering green power. And we are delivering the jobs, he said. The work here in New Bedford is a symbol for the green energy transition and the move from black, dirty fossil fuels to nice, green energy. Jennifer D'Aloisio, CEO of the Massachusetts Clean Energy Center, the owner and operator of the New Bedford Marine Commerce Terminal, said Mass CEC has been laying the groundwork for the offshore wind industry since 2010 when it commissioned a port study to look at offshore wind ports that could be used for this industry. It proudly stands today as the only port in the country purpose-built for the offshore wind industry, she said. It took really visionary and courageous leadership from partners in the community, government, the legislature, and industry to see that building this port was a critical step in bringing offshore wind to the U.S. and putting Massachusetts on the map as a leader. She said communities along the coast have already begun to see the impact with economic growth and jobs from manufacturing to installation to operations and maintenance, and they're grateful to have longtime support from their partners in the trades. Frank Callahan, president of the Massachusetts Building Trades Unions, said it was a gamble to build the Marine Commerce Terminal to support offshore wind, with credit to former Governor Deval Patrick. But it was also about making sure that South Coast residents have access to career opportunities in the building trades to earn good family-sustaining wages and benefits with safe working conditions. We negotiated a project labor agreement for the construction of this facility, and that continued with the legislation to move forward to make sure that there's a project labor agreement for this project, he said. Jeff Lewis, the GE project director, said they're honored to have the opportunity to deliver the first components to the Port of New Bedford and install one of the world's largest offshore wind farms ever. On the deck of the ship are shipping cradles that the towers for the 13 megawatts turbines are sitting in, and underneath there's a hold for additional tower sections. Moving inside the paper, to the Cape and Islands section, as we keep it local here at the Audible Local Ledger. Nobsca Point Light offered for free by feds to Falmouth and Friends Group, by Zane Razak. A nonprofit group wants to continue to keep watch over an iconic centuries-old lighthouse in Woods Hole. The federal government is making Nobska Point Light available for free to either local nonprofits or to government entities. The town and the Friends of Nobska Light, an organization dedicated to restoring the lighthouse, have each submitted a letter of interest. Kathleen Walrath, president of the Friends of Nobska Light, called the move expected and welcomed. "All the work we've been doing aligns with this next step in Nobska's history," said Walrath. "The lighthouse is on a rocky point jutting over the entrance to Woods Hole Harbor and the junction of Vineyard and Nantucket Sounds with Buzzards Bay, according to the National Register of Historic Places website. For 111 years, from 1828 to 1939, the U.S. Lighthouse Service operated the lighthouse. In 1939, the service merged with the U.S. Coast Guard, which then took over operations, according to the Coast Guard's website. In 2016, the Coast Guard awarded stewardship of the property to Falmouth. The Select Board then approved a license agreement and memorandum of understanding with the Friends of Nobska Light to pass responsibility for upkeep, programming, and fundraising to the nonprofit. Since Congress approved the 2000 National Historic Lighthouse Preservation Act, 150 lighthouses have been given to new owners in a program that was run by the U.S. General Services Administration. That includes 81 lights to local governments and nonprofits through no-cost transfers and about 70 sold via public auction, raising over $10 million. This year, the record number of lighthouses offered for nonprofits and government entities features the Nobska Point Light and at least five others, including Plymouth Gurnett Lighthouse, Warwick Neck Light in Rhode Island, and Lind Point Lighthouse in Old Saybrook, Connecticut. The U.S. General Services Administration issued a notice of availability for Nobska Point Light on its website May 15th. Letters of interest must be submitted 60 days after the notice has been published. The General Services Administration and National Park Service would schedule a site visit as the next step. At that point, Walrath said the Friends of Nobska Light and the town will get together and decide how to submit the strongest application. The National Park Service will examine the applications before making recommendations to the General Service Administration, and the entire process could take several years, she said. Entities applying to own a lighthouse must be able to financially maintain the station and make it available for education, recreation, cultural, or historic preservation for the public at reasonable times and under reasonable conditions, according to the news release. If a nonprofit or government entity is not approved as the new owner, the lighthouse may be auctioned to the public. The Lighthouse Preservation Act ensures lighthouses stay accessible to the public unless the National Park Service can't find a nonprofit or a municipality that will take it on, said Walrath. That's the only time it would go to auction, said Walrath. Additionally, at least four will be sold to the public through auctions, including Penfield Reef Lighthouse in Fairfield, Connecticut. Auction sales have brought in between $10,000 and $933,888. To make sure the lighthouse remains a beacon in Falmouth, the Friends of Nobska Light have been hard at work to restore property, said Walrath. Once restoration is complete, the lighthouse will operate as a maritime museum. In 2019, the group started to preserve the tower head, removing any rust and damage that had settled in over the years. It's now received a full rehabilitation, and it's now well-preserved, requiring maintenance every 5 years. We'd lose parts of it if we didn't act, said Walrath. Work to preserve the exterior of the house was completed in 2020, and the group's now just finishing up the final pieces of preserving the interior. Making the site compliant with the Americans with Disabilities Act has also been a priority, including an accessible pathway leading to the tower and keeper's house. Once the occupancy permit is received, Walrath estimates that the tower and keeper's house will be open to the public sometime this summer. The original lighthouse was built in 1828, with Nobska Light establishing the following year. That lighthouse was later replaced with the current structure and lightkeeper's house built in 1876, according to the Coast Guard's website. The 40-foot cast iron tower was built in Chelsea and taken to Woods Hole in four sections. It consists of four rings of iron panels, and it's capped with a standard cast iron lantern, according to its property description. The tower was originally fitted with a fifth order Fresnel lens, an invention that gathers light to concentrate and steer the beam in one direction. Later in 1888, a larger fourth order Fresnel lens replaced it. That lens still tops the tower, and the Ghost Guard will retain it. Joseph Hindley, the last civilian lightkeeper, retired in 1972. He was then replaced by active duty Coast Guard enlisted personnel. The light later was fully automated in 1985, and 2 years later it was placed on the National Register of Historic Places. The four-acre property also includes the original keeper's quarters, the brick oil house, and paint lockers, which were all built in 1876. A second keeper's quarters, which connects to the original, was added in 1900, a garage was built in 1931, and the radio building beacon was built in 1937. The keeper's quarters are Cape-style wood frame buildings with gabled roofs. Zane Razak writes about housing and real estate, and you can reach her at zrazzaq@capecodonline.com. Advice and research improve Cape transportation plans, a born leader says, by Paul Gately as a special to the Cape Cod Times in Buzzards Bay. Select board member Judith Froman of North Sagamore said goodbye, for now, on May 9th, in subdued fashion, saying her departure after 2 3-year terms was bittersweet, but that her executive-level experience was worthwhile. Her government tenure, however, is not over. Froman remains the Upper Cape representative to the 11-member Cape Cod Metropolitan Planning Organization through December. She was elected to the influential panel by select board members in the four Upper Cape towns. She established herself as one to dive into issues with research and outreach. She said in a recent email that she'd like to integrate regional transportation planning with Cape Cod Canal Bridge replacement planning by the end of December. Judy's been an excellent MPO member with lots of projects flowing through its review, Bourne Select Board member Peter Mayer said in a May 12th interview. She does her homework, and she digs in and looks at everything. She doesn't let up. Froman chose not to seek a third term on the Select Board. The Select Board in Bourne needs to discuss who it might nominate for the next representative come 2024, Mayer said. Froman may serve on the regional panel until December 31st, after which Upper Cape Select Boards will nominate replacements for an ultimate election, according to Cape Cod Commission's communications manager, Sarah Colvin, in an email. The election for the next 3-year term will occur in the fall, and the specific process and dates for the election will be reviewed and approved at a June meeting of the regional panel, Colvin said. The Cape Cod Regional Panel is divided into four subregions that are based on geography. As a whole, the panel oversees regional transportation planning and recommends distribution of transportation funds in Barnstable County. It's chaired by Gina Fiandaca, the State Department of Transportation Secretary. The Cape Cod Joint Transportation Committee is an advisory group to the Regional Transportation Panel. The committee reviews, discusses, and votes on recommendations to the regional panel. Bourne Public Works Director Sean Patterson is a member of the advisory group. Upper Cape projects, as of May 22, included in the Draft Transportation Improvement Program, which is known as a TIP, for federal fiscal year 24 and all the way through 28, include in Sandwich, the Quaker Meeting House Road Bridge over Route 6 for 2024, in Bourne, a rail trail bike path first phase for 2025, also in Bourne, a Route 6 scenic highway median installation for 2025, and also resurfacing and related work on Route 28 in 2028, and in Falmouth, resurfacing and related work on Route 28 for 2028. In total, across the Cape, the fiscal year 2024-28 transportation improvement planning includes over $430 million in funded projects. So what are the concerns in Bourne, specifically for transportation projects? The rail trail design future in the second, third, and fourth phases remains a political talking point, given the $20 million in COVID-19 federal relief funds that Governor Maura Healey may or may not direct to the State Department of Transportation for removing railroad tracks along the Buzzards Bay shoreline. But Mass Coastal Railroad opposes a rip-up-the-tracks bike trail construction idea. The unexpended COVID-19 relief funds may possibly fall victim to federal spending cuts and debt limit talks in Washington, Select Board member Peter Mayer said on May 29th. Another proposal that's been in and out of the state transportation pipeline is the Route 6 median installations along the heavily traveled roadway north of the Cape Cod Canal. That's been discussed in the late 1970s and in the early 80s. Froman, in terms of that proposal, says there must be a champion to move projects forward and that they must be involved in it for the long haul. The Cape Cod Joint Transportation Committee is actively involved with advising the regional panel, she said. The Cape Cod Commission, she added, does research and analyzes data used in developing rating systems and priorities. The ongoing updated research, as well as the ever-changing town leadership, influences the annual review and preparation of the five-year TIP plans, Froman said. I'm confident that in the 1970s and 1980s, there was no county and state or federal framework that currently exists. So what will be happening with regional transportation planning through the year's end? This is the time plans for specific project spending for vehicles, bicycles, trains, transit, and ferries are reviewed and put into place for the federal fiscal year that starts in October, Froman said. Part of the planning looks at major congestion areas and ways to improve the movement of people. It's my hope to integrate regional planning together with canal bridge replacement planning before December 31st. She said there are numerous factors that are reviewed when transportation proposals reach the project phase and climb to placement on the Transportation Improvement Program list, the TIP list. In most cases, it takes at least a couple years to even be considered for the five-year TIP, she said. Safety and readiness are just a couple of the factors. Some recommendations come from local municipalities, others from the regional planning, and others strictly through the state DOT, she said. Froman emphasized that the regional transportation panel planning and the transportation improvement program listing don't play a part in plans to replace the Sagamore and Bourne bridges. The next headline reads, Ruling Clears Way for Purdue Pharma Deal, by Jeff Mulvihill of the Associated Press. A federal court ruling cleared the way Tuesday for OxyContin maker Purdue Pharma's settlement of thousands of legal claims over the toll of opioids. The Second U.S. Circuit Court of Appeals in New York reversed a 2021 ruling that found bankruptcy court judges did not have the authority to shield from civil lawsuits members of the Sackler family who own Purdue and who have not filed for bankruptcy protection themselves. Those protections are at the heart of the proposed deal that would end claims against Purdue that were filed by thousands of state, local, and Native American tribal governments and other entities. Under the plan, members of the Sackler family would give up ownership of Stamford, Connecticut-based Purdue, which would become a new company known as NOAA, K-N-O-A, with its profits being used to fight the opioid crisis. They would also contribute $5.5 to $6 billion in cash over time. A chunk of that money, at least $750 million, is to go to individual victims of the opioid crisis and their survivors. Sackler family members have been clear. If they don't get the legal protections, they won't do their part of the deal. Several states had been withholding support for the plan, but after a new round of negotiations this year, all of them came on board. That left just one high-profile objector, the Office of the U.S. Bankruptcy Trustee, which is an arm of the Justice Department. A lawyer from that office told the Second Circuit in April of 2022 that it's a fundamental inconsistency that people who don't seek bankruptcy protection and have to give up most of their assets could be exempted from some lawsuits. The settlement must still be approved by a bankruptcy court judge before it can be finalized. There's also a chance the new ruling could be put on hold, pending an appeal to the U.S. Supreme Court. Purdue is perhaps the highest-profile player in the opioid industry, but several other drug makers, distribution companies, and pharmacies also have been sued by state and local governments. While a handful of cases have gone to trial, many are being settled. We are at the midway portion of our reading. Regular listeners are aware, I'm sure, it's at this stage when we move to a different kind of local news, which is the obituaries and today's death notices that are listed in the Cape Cod Times e-edition. Today's date is Wednesday, May 31st of 2023. The first obituary is of Dorothy Thelma Noak of Centerville, who at the age of 94 passed on Tuesday, May 23rd. Noak, a lifelong artist, would often say art wasn't what she did. It was the essence of who she was. Known by many who loved her as Dama, she was a shining light, touched so many lives with her selfless heart and her incredible laugh. She truly made everyone around her smile, feel loved, and appreciated. Dama's sense of humor and silliness was special, and she knew how to have fun better than anyone. She was forever young at heart, a truly compassionate and joyful soul. A remembrance service will be held Saturday, June 3rd, from 1 to 3 p.m. at Harbor Church, 957 Falmouth Road in Hyannis. The dress is happy. The next obituary is of Ira Franklin Silverman of Sebastian, Florida, who passed at the age of 82 on May 17th. Ira was born November 3rd, 1940, in the Bronx, New York, worked for many years as a clinical psychologist before practicing as a forensic psychologist in Massachusetts up until his retirement. He was predeceased in death by his only sibling and is survived by Carol Rachel Silverman, his wife of 47 years, and many who will miss him dearly. Services will be held on June 17th at 1 p.m. on Block Island. In lieu of flowers, the family requests donations be made to the Michael J. Fox Foundation for Parkinson's Research in his memory. The next obituary is of Doris M. Horton of Northborough, who at the age of 101 passed on May 26th. She was born in 1922 and worked for 27 years as a CNA before retiring at the age of 80, a proud Cape Codder. She was married to the late Robert William Horton and has many family and friends who will miss her dearly. A graveside service in her honor will be held at Swan Lake Cemetery, Depot Street in Dennis, on Friday, June 2nd, that's this Friday, at 2 p.m. In lieu of flowers, any donations in Doris's memory can be made to the MSPCA at 1577 Falmouth Road in Centerville, Mass. The next obituary is of a veteran, Joseph Max Mendez, Sr. of Mashpee, who passed at the age of 88 on February 1st. Joseph was a man of many trades, a college-educated veteran with a passion and extreme talent for art. He was a coach, multi-business owner, and president of Head Start. He showed his support for his community through being an advocate for disabilities and housing, his love for travel, especially alongside his wife, Augustina, and family. But most importantly, Joseph was known for his caring heart. His beautiful life will be forever cherished by his wife, children, grandchildren, great-grandchildren, and loved ones. He is survived by his wife, Augustina of Mashpee, and many who will miss him. Visiting hours on Saturday, this Saturday, June 3rd, from 1 to 3 p.m. in the Chapman Funeral and Cremations in John Lawrence Chapel. That's located at 3778 Falmouth Road, Marston's Mills. A funeral service will follow in the funeral home at 3 p.m. The next obituary is of another veteran, Earl A. Beardsley of South Dennis, who at the age of 91 passed on May 24th. He was beloved husband of the late Mary Elizabeth Beardsley, with whom he shared 50 years of marriage until her passing in 2008. Earl was born in Cambridge on February 14th of 1932 and proudly served his country as a member of the U.S. Air Force during the Korean War. Thank you, Mr. Beardsley, for your service, and thank you, Mr. Mendez, for your service. Earl met his wife Liz at the Philip Brooks Club, the Trinity Episcopal Church in Boston. They were married on August 16th of 1958, and Earl spent his career working as a mechanical engineer. He was the founder and president of Datamark. In 1994, Earl and Liz retired to South Dennis, and in his later years, Earl enjoyed flipping houses on Cape Cod. He'll be remembered by all those who knew him for his kind spirit and generous nature. A funeral service will be held tomorrow, Thursday, June 1st, at 1 p.m. at Christ Church Episcopal, 671 Route 28 in Harwichport. The interment will follow in South Dennis Cemetery, 234 Main Street in South Dennis. The next obituary is of Kevin Roger Donahue of Dennisport, who at the age of 81 passed on May 19th. Kevin was born May 6th, 1942, in Buffalo, New York. He earned a B.S. from Rochester Institute of Technology and went on to a successful career in the photographic industry, including 30 years at Eastman Kodak and executive roles at Qualex and Fuji. A yacht master, he crossed the Atlantic in a 62-foot sailboat at 55 years old and raced the Fastnet and Newport to Bermuda. A consummate storyteller, Kevin often shared tales with a large gin and tonic in hand. He was a lifelong Buffalo Bills fan who attended all four of their Super Bowls. He's survived by his wife, Martine Donahue, of London, England, and many who will miss him. Kevin's ashes will be spread in the Atlantic Ocean near Chatham, Massachusetts. The next obituaries of another veteran, Richard J. Allain of West Yarmouth, who at the age of 90 passed on May 25th. He was beloved husband of the late Marjorie Allain. Richard was born on August 27, 1932, in Leominster, Massachusetts, and proudly served in the U.S. Army in Kaiserslautern, Germany, as a quartermaster. Thank you, Mr. Allain, for your service. Upon returning to the U.S., he earned his bachelor's and master's degrees and built a career teaching in Lunenburg, Mass., while raising a family. He married Margie, the love of his life, in 1959, and they lived together in Leominster and Brandon, Suffolk, in the U.K., before retiring to Wellfleet. A fiercely independent traveler, his journeys took him across the U.S., to England and most of Western Europe, and to his beloved Canada. He dedicated his adult life to his extended family, his coin collection, and helping anyone in the community who needed a hand. The family sends heartfelt thanks to the staff and caregivers of Regal Care at Harwich and Beacon Hospice. A private interment will be at the Veterans Cemetery in Winchendon, Mass. Any donations may be made in Richard's memory to the Wellfleet Shellfish Harvester Relief Fund or to the American Heart Association. And our final obituary in today's Cape Cod Times that's dated Wednesday, May 31st of 2023 is of Annette L. Oakley of Mashpee, who at the age of 40 passed on May 26th. She was loving daughter of James Brito and Shirley Oakley. She graduated from Stone Academy of Nursing in East Hartford, Connecticut, and worked as an LPN at Bloomfield Healthcare Nursing Home for many years. She was a member of the Mashpee Wampanoag Tribe and VFW Auxiliary Post 5489. As a loving and caring professional, she enjoyed her career as a nurse. A visitation will be held at the Old Indian Meeting House, 410 Meeting House Road in Mashpee, on Thursday, June 1st, that's tomorrow, from 10 a.m. to 11 a.m. A funeral service will follow in the Old Indian Meeting House at 11 a.m. Burial will follow in the Old Indian Meeting House Cemetery. Donations may be made to the Elders Travel Club, P.O. Box 78 in Mashpee. And that concludes the obituaries that are listed in today's e-edition of the Cape Cod Times, dated Wednesday, May 31st of 2023. Heading back to the front page, there's some national news. Biden works to rally debt deal support. Crucial days ahead as agreement goes for vote. By Lisa Mascaro and Amer Madani of the Associated Press in Washington. President Joe Biden says he feels good about the debt ceiling and budget deal negotiated with House Speaker Kevin McCarthy as the White House and congressional leaders work to ensure its passage this time, in time to lift the nation's borrowing limit and prevent a disastrous U.S. default. Biden spent part of the Memorial Day holiday calling lawmakers in both parties as the president does his part to deliver the votes. A number of hard-right conservatives are criticizing the deal as falling short of the deep spending cuts they wanted, while liberals decry policy changes such as new work requirements for older Americans in the food aid program. A key test was to come Tuesday afternoon when the House Rules Committee was scheduled to consider the package and vote on sending it to the full House for a vote that was expected Wednesday. "I feel very good about it," Biden told reporters Monday as he left Washington for his home in Delaware. "I've spoken to a number of the members," he said, among them Senate Republican leader Mitch McConnell, a past partner in big bipartisan deals, who largely sat this one out. "I spoke to a whole bunch of people, and it feels good," Biden said. To those progressive Democrats raising concerns about the package, the president had a simple message: "Talk to me." As lawmakers size up the 99-page bill, few are expected to be fully satisfied with the final product. But Biden, a Democrat, and McCarthy, a Republican, are counting on pulling majority support from the political center, a rarity in divided Washington, to join in voting to prevent a catastrophic federal default. McCarthy acknowledged the hard-fought compromise with Biden will not be 100% what everybody wants as he leads a slim House majority powered by hard-right conservatives. Facing potential blowback from his conservative ranks, the Republican speaker will have to rely on upward of half the House Democrats and half the House Republicans to push the debt ceiling package to passage. Overall, the package is a trade-off that would impose some spending reductions for the next 2 years, along with a suspension of the debt limit into January of 2025, pushing the volatile political issue past the next presidential election. Raising the debt limit, now $31 trillion, would allow Treasury to continue borrowing to pay the nation's already incurred bills. Additionally, policy issues are raising the most objections from lawmakers. Liberal lawmakers fought hard, but were unable to stop new work requirements for people 50 to 54 who receive government food assistance and are otherwise able-bodied without dependents. The Republicans demanded the bolstered work requirements as part of the deal, but some say the changes to the food stamp program aren't enough. The Republicans were also pushing to beef up work requirements for health care and other aid. Biden refused to go along on those. Questions are also being raised about an unexpected provision that essentially gives congressional approval to the Mountain Valley Pipeline, a natural gas project important to Senator Joe Manchin, a Democrat from West Virginia that many Democrats and others oppose. At the same time, conservative Republicans, including those from the House Freedom Caucus, say the budget slashing doesn't go nearly far enough to have their support. "No one claiming to be a conservative could justify a yes vote," tweeted Representative Bob Good, a Republican from Virginia. "This deal is insanity," said Representative Ralph Norman, a Republican from South Carolina. "Not gonna vote to bankrupt our country." All told, the package would hold spending essentially flat for the coming year, while allowing increases for military and veterans accounts. It would cap growth at 1% for 2025. The House Rules Committee has three members from the influential Freedom Caucus who may very well try to block the package from advancing, forcing McCarthy to rely on the Democrats on the panel to ensure the bill can be sent to the House floor. The House aims to vote Wednesday and send the bill to the Senate, where Majority Leader Chuck Schumer, along with McConnell, are working for a quick passage by week's end. Senators who have remained largely on the sidelines during much of the negotiations between the president and the House Speaker began inserting themselves more forcefully into the debate. Some senators are insisting on amendments to reshape the package from both the left and right flanks. That could require time-consuming debates that delay final approval of the deal. Democratic Senator Tim Kaine of Virginia is extremely disappointed by the provision greenlighting the controversial Mountain Valley Pipeline, his office said in a statement. He plans to file an amendment to remove the provision from the package. Republican Senator Lindsey Graham of South Carolina complained that the military spending increases aren't enough. I'll use all powers available to me in the Senate to have amendment votes to undo this catastrophe for defense, he tweeted. But making any changes to the package at this stage seems highly unlikely with so little time to spare. Congress and the White House are racing to meet the Monday deadline, now less than a week away. That's when Treasury Secretary Janet Yellen has said the U.S. would run short of cash and face an unprecedented debt default without action. A default would almost certainly crush the U.S. economy and spill over around the globe as the world's reliance on the stability of the American dollar and the country's leadership fall into question. Drones strike Moscow buildings by Susie Bland and Joanna Kozlovska of the Associated Press in Kyiv, Ukraine. A rare drone attack jolted Moscow early on Tuesday, causing only light damage, but forcing evacuations as residential buildings were struck in the Russian capital for the first time in the war against Ukraine. The Kremlin, meanwhile, pursued its relentless bombardment of Kyiv with a third assault on the city in 24 hours. The Russian Defense Ministry said five drones were shot down in Moscow and the systems of three others were jammed, causing them to veer off course. President Vladimir Putin called it a terrorist act by Kyiv. The attack, while causing only what Moscow Mayor Sergei Sobyanin said was insignificant damage to several buildings, brought the war home to civilians in Russia's capital. Two people received treatment for unspecified injuries, but didn't need hospitalization, he said in a Telegram post, adding that residents of two high-rise buildings damaged in the attack were evacuated. Andrei Vorobyov, governor of the wider Moscow region, said some of the drones were shot down on the approach to Moscow. Ukraine made no direct comment on the attack, which would be one of its deepest and most daring strikes into Russia since the Kremlin launched its full-scale invasion of Ukraine more than 15 months ago. Putin said Moscow's air defense worked in a satisfactory way, but added, "It is clear that our task is to plug the gaps in the system." The Kyiv regime attempted to intimidate Russian citizens in strikes at civilian buildings, he said at a public event, responding to a question from the head of a Kremlin-allied think tank. It is, of course, a clear indication of terrorist activity. Putin claimed Tuesday Kyiv attack was in response to Russia's striking of Ukraine's military intelligence headquarters days earlier. But Andriy Cherniak, a Ukrainian intelligence representative, said the Kremlin's forces failed to hit the building because its missiles were shot down. Asked by the Associated Press whether there's high-level concern that the invasion of Ukraine is endangering Russian civilians, Kremlin spokesman Dmitry Peskov said only that attacks on Russia reinforce the need to prosecute the war. Still, the attacks raised questions about the effectiveness of Russia's air defenses. A senior Russian lawmaker, Andrei Kartopolov, told Russian business news site RBC that we have a very big country. There will always be a loophole where the drone can fly around the areas where air defense systems are located. Kartopolov said that the purpose of the attacks were to unnerve the Russian people. It's an intimidation act aimed at the civilian population, RBC quoted him as saying. Moscow residents reported hearing explosions before dawn. Police were seen working at one site of a crashed drone in southwest Moscow. An area near a residential building was fenced off, and police put the drone debris in a cardboard box before carrying it away. At another site, apartment windows were shattered, and there were scorch marks on the building's front. It was the second reported attack on Moscow. Russian authorities said two drones targeted the Kremlin May 3rd in what they portrayed as an attempt on Putin's life. Ukraine denied it was behind that attack. Last week, the Russian border region of Belgorod was the target of one of the most serious cross-border raids since the war began, with two far-right pro-Ukrainian paramilitary groups claiming responsibility. Officials in the southern Russian city of Krasnodar, near annexed Crimea, said two drones struck there Friday, damaging residential buildings. Other drones have reportedly flown deep into Russia multiple times. In December, Russia claimed it had shot down drones at airfields in the Saratov and Ryazan regions in western Russia. Three soldiers were reported killed in the attack in Saratov, which targeted an important military airfield. Before that, Russia reported downing a drone that targeted the headquarters of its Black Sea Fleet in the Crimean port of Sevastopol. Ukrainian military analysts, though unable to confirm Kyiv had launched the drones against Moscow, said the attack may have involved UJ-22 drones, which are produced in Ukraine, with a maximum range of about 620 miles. Analyst Oleg Zhdanov said some UJ-22s are capable of reaching Moscow and beyond, although he noted they can fly only half as far and carry half the payload of the Iranian-made Shahed drones that are used in the war by Russia. Even so, Zhdanov told AP that the myth has been dispelled of the Russian capital's invulnerability. Since February, when a UJ-22 crashed 60 miles from Moscow, Ukrainian drones have repeatedly approached the Russian capital. The White House National Security Council said in a statement that it was still gathering information about what happened in Moscow, but generally, we do not support attacks inside of Russia. It noted that Russia's bombardment of Kyiv was the 17th round of attacks this month, many of which have devastated civilian areas. Ukrainian officials said the pre-dawn air raid on Kyiv killed at least one person, it wounded 11 others, and sent residents again scrambling into shelters. At least 20 Shahed drones were destroyed by air defense forces in Kyiv in the latest attack on the Ukrainian capital. Overall, Ukraine shot down 29 of 31 drones, mostly in the Kyiv area, the Air Force said. Before daylight, buzzing drones could be heard in the city, followed by loud explosions as they were taken down by air defense systems. Burned-out cars, glass, and debris littered the street outside a building where apartments were wrecked. A woman in Kyiv's Holosiv district was killed when she came onto her balcony to look at the drones being shot down, Mayor Vitaly Klitschko said in a Telegram post. A high-rise in the same district caught fire after being hit by debris, either from drones or interceptor missiles. The building's upper two floors were destroyed and people were feared to be buried in the rubble, the Kyiv military administration said. More than 20 people were evacuated. Next headline, study finds New York City is slowly sinking as waters rise, by Bobby Kana Calvan of the Associated Press in New York. If rising oceans aren't worry enough, add this to the risks New York City faces. The metropolis is slowly sinking under the weight of its skyscrapers, homes, asphalt, and humanity itself. New research estimates the city's landmass is sinking at an average rate of 1 to 2 millimeters per year, something referred to as subsidence. That natural process happens everywhere as ground is compressed, but the study published this month in the journal's Earth Future sought to estimate how the massive weight of the city itself is hurrying things along. More than a million buildings are spread across the city's five boroughs. The research team calculated that all those structures add up to 1.7 trillion tons of concrete, metal, and glass, about the mass of 4,700 Empire State Buildings pressing down on the earth. The rate of compression varies throughout the city. Midtown Manhattan's skyscrapers are largely built on rock, which compresses very little, while some parts of Brooklyn, Queens, and downtown Manhattan are on looser soil, and they're sinking faster, the study revealed. While the process is slow, lead researcher Tom Parsons of the U.S. Geological Survey said parts of the city will eventually be underwater. It's inevitable. The ground is going down, the water's coming up. At some point, those two levels will meet, said Parsons, whose job is to forecast hazardous events from earthquakes and tsunamis to incremental shifts of the ground below us. But no need to invest in life preservers just yet, Parsons assured. The study notes buildings themselves are contributing, albeit incrementally, to the shifting landscape, he said. Parsons and his team of researchers reached their conclusions using satellite imaging, data modeling, and a lot of mathematical assumptions. It will take hundreds of years, precisely when is unclear, before New York becomes America's version of Venice, which is famously sinking into the Adriatic Sea. But parts of the city are more at risk. There's a lot of weight there, a lot of people there, Parsons said, referring specifically to Manhattan. The average elevation in the southern part of the island is only 1 or 2 meters above sea level. It is very close to the waterline, and so that's a deep concern. Because the ocean is rising at a similar rate as the land is sinking, the Earth's changing climate could accelerate the timeline for parts of the city to disappear underwater. Doesn't mean that we should stop building buildings, Parsons said. Doesn't mean that the buildings are themselves the sole cause of this. There are a lot of factors. The purpose was to point this out in advance before it becomes a bigger problem. Already, New York City's at risk of flooding because of massive storms that can cause the ocean to swell inland or inundate neighborhoods with torrential rain. The resulting flooding could have destructive and deadly consequences, as demonstrated by Superstorm Sandy a decade ago and the still potent remnants of Hurricane Ida 2 years ago. The study's findings could help inform policymakers as they draft ongoing plans to combat, or at least forestall, the rising tides. We'll close with a little bit of advice. Ask Carolyn for it. Mom and sister's private email finds its way to him. Dear Carolyn, recently an email exchange between my mother and my sister ended up in my inbox, I can only assume by mistake. It was full of criticism and hurtful comments. I had no idea either one of them had an issue with my family or the way we're raising our kids. My wife was my only saving grace. She read the message, deleted it, and helped me let my frustrations out to her so I wouldn't say anything to them and do permanent damage. We are supposed to see these family members soon. I want to go and try to enjoy the day, but I'm fearful I might slip. So what should I do? Signed, Stressed Out Son. Dear Stressed Out Son, you're right. Your wife made an elegant save. Unleashing the raw emotions of your discovery would probably have made things worse. Now that you've had time to collect yourself, though, you can figure out your next move by gauging whether you'll be able to get past this. No doubt you're hurt. That's a given. The question is whether this pain is out of proportion to your other feelings about your sister and mom. One way to approach it is to consider things you've said to your mom about your sister, or to your sister about your mom, and then to your wife about both of them. Imagine what would happen if these conversations ever fell into the wrong hands. I'd use that to remind yourself that exchanges intended to be in confidence aren't always pretty. As long as they aren't motivated by spite, they can help friends and family understand each other, work through grievances, and even warn each other when something's amiss. If the email could be considered well-meaning, then you have grounds for a conscious decision to just let go. If, on the other hand, there's no room to interpret the message as anything but mean-spirited, well, then you might reasonably expect the injuries won't heal on their own. If so, you owe it to yourself to say, calmly, to your mom or sister that you received the email. You obviously aren't planning to estrange yourself from the family. So that leaves you with two plain, if difficult, choices. Make peace with them, or make peace with yourself. And with that good advice, we've come to the end of our reading of today's e-edition of the Cape Cod Times, which is dated Wednesday, May 31st of 2023. This is your reader, Eric, saying, be well, be safe, look after each other. Remember our veterans, not just on Memorial Day. Bye for now.